Welcome to a special holiday episode of The Civilist from WUNC and PRI. I'm Stephen Petro, and Kim Severson of The New York Times is joining me today as co-host. We promise to give you our best advice to make your Thanksgiving, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, or Christmas, yes, we're very inclusive, run smoothly. And that's whether we're talking politics or turkey. Today, Kim and I will tackle how to keep the peace at your holiday table, especially after this brutal election season, where hosts should draw the line at serving those who are choosy about what they will eat, and how to be a good guest. Hint, it starts with a prompt RSVP and bringing the right attitude. All that and more coming right up on The Civilist. It may or may not be the most wonderful time of the year, as the Christmas carol goes, but it most certainly is a time when we break bread and come together, whether we're visiting friends and family or hosting them in our homes. And in that spirit, I've invited my long-term pal, Kim Severson, to be my co-host. Kim writes and cooks for The New York Times and the New York Times cooking app. She's the mother of an 8-year-old, and she joins me from Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Kim, thank you for coming back.
Oh, Stephen, any time spent with you is time well spent.
Well, I was lonely, and so let's have some fun. Let's solve some problems in the world, okay?
It's the holiday season. We need to have fun.
Speaking of fun, I'm dreading this Thanksgiving sit-down. I think especially because it comes less than 3 weeks after this election, which has been called the most uncivil in modern American history, where we have been defriending, blocking, and shouting at each other online and offline for months, if not a year and a half. You know, and so many of us are hurting, while many are jubilant. So what are you planning for your Thanksgiving, and what are your thoughts about this holiday?
I'll tell you, it is certainly one in which both pain and gloating need to be avoided. I am going full Thanksgiving this year. Uncle Harold is coming, nieces and nephews, friends with their twin 10-year-olds, a dog, maybe a neighbor. So my approach is going to be to turn to the stove, go full food, and then focus on community with a capital C. I think the food is going to be the healer of this holiday season.
Well, they say food is medicine. I'm going to be whipping up one of my, I say, world-famous pecan pies, only because it's been in the New York Times.
Yes, it has. Thank you very much.
I like to call that the pie that binds us, more in a metaphoric than a literal way, because our family has enjoyed that pie for decades now, and I think it reminds us of what we share in common rather than what divides us. But I do have to say that this election season and this Thanksgiving seem different than others. So I want to remind cooks and hosts that they are not only in charge of the food, but they are the chief manners officers, and they get to set the rules. So that means what happens at your house and your table is up to you. And so ahead of time, you might say, we're all going to be nice this year. We're going to respect each other. We're not going to follow through on all that flaming that was happening. You also might designate dinner time for a politics-free moment where you're not going to come at each other. And everyone needs to remember we need to start listening to each other again. We've been in our silos. We've been in these echo chambers, and we're not listening. And so this is actually a great time to open our ears and start to hear what those of us have to say that may be different, but we still love them. We're still connected to them. So Kim, what's some of your advice today?
Well, I agree. It's important for the host to be in charge of making sure that explosions don't happen. And if they do, I think it's up to you to give people some really good off-ramps from the conversation. So if somebody starts in on somebody, you can go, you know, I am really exhausted and I'd prefer we don't talk about politics, but Aunt Jackie, didn't you just finish training for that marathon? Or, well, now, Bill, didn't you just come back from Sri Lanka? Tell us a little bit about that. Like, you almost need to be, like a great late-night TV host and give people an opportunity to take a detour away from those politics. And it's not easy to do, but I think if you do it with an open heart and with concern for everybody at the table, it can be done with grace. And that's the key, right?
Absolutely. I will also tell you something I did probably 10 or 15 years ago. A new spouse was at the table and he was voicing some racial insensitivities. I'll put it that way. And so what I did was I went and tapped him on the shoulder and I said, can you help me in the kitchen? We went into the kitchen. I closed the door and I said, look, it's my house. You can't be talking like that at my table. Thank you. And we went back in. Everyone had a lovely time. He had heard me. You know, I didn't call him out in public, but, you know, this is an example where people need to be paying attention to everybody at the table and, you know, taking care of their comfort.
I don't know how to say this, but I am really fed up with people and their dietary restrictions. God knows I try to be sensitive to these sorts of things because I want to cook food people want to eat. You know, that's my goal. I'm a cook. I love seeing somebody happy at the end of a meal. But I think we've become a nation where our own personal needs are superseding that of the group or the community. So, for example, somebody might come to your house and you have cooked a beautiful meal that might contain meat. They might let you know that they're a vegetarian and they won't eat any meat, and or perhaps that they are completely gluten-free and they really can't eat anything that you've offered. And it becomes all about them. Or the person who calls ahead of time and says, my daughter's not eating any corn or any nightshades like eggplant, and we're also only eating organic, just to let you know. I mean, that is the most challenging thing for a cook because you want to say, oh, I'm sorry, we've actually canceled dinner. You know, I think when you cook for someone, you're giving them a gift. It's an act of communion. I make something and I give it to you and you take it. And in that transaction, more happens than in the transaction in which I bend over backwards to deal with your dietary needs. Now, I'm not talking about somebody who is a true celiac and is really going to get ill if they eat something. I'm not talking about serving pork to a devout Muslim, things that are really, you know, overt issues. But if you have some dietary needs and you can maybe get through one meal without either indulging them or by just eating around them and not making it about you, do that. Be a great guest. Consider for a moment that this is about the communion, the gift of someone giving you food, and don't make it all about you.
I'm coming over because I you know, like, there are certain things that I prefer not to eat, but, you know, the holidays really are not about me. And, you know, I don't have food allergies, which can be a matter of life and death. And actually, I say when it comes to food allergies, Kim, if I'm cooking, I want you to tell me ahead of time, I'm allergic to nuts. I'm allergic to whatever that is, because that I should know and I should be able to provide other options for you. Or you can bring a dish that will meet your food needs in that way. And I say bring enough to share. But, you know, what I am seeing these days is that, well, I don't like such and such becomes a food allergy all of a sudden rather than a food preference. And so here, you know, people are kind of mangling the language to get more of what they want or don't want. And that makes cooks crazy. And then you kind of have this whole divided table, which is representative of our divided nation. So, you know, when we talk about breaking bread, we were not specifically talking about breaking gluten and gluten-free bread. You know, the metaphor, you know, really, really matters here.
I think you're right. And it's about inclusion and not exclusion. And depending on which version of the Thanksgiving mythology you buy into, I'm sure the starving immigrants from England did not say to the Indians, this acorn flour, really, I'm allergic. I can't have that.
So let's talk about alcohol for a moment. So neither of us is a big drinker, and I've seen that that can become uncomfortable at holiday celebrations. So how do you think hosts should handle people like us with grace and consideration?
Well, right. I actually have not had a drink for 18 years and have gone through many a holiday. Thank you. Many, trust me, you don't want me drinking at your Thanksgiving, Stephen. Just trust me on that. but I have gone through more than one holiday season. And I'll tell you, if someone hands me another glass of Martinelli's sparkling apple cider and pretends it's champagne, oh, I'm just not sure I can handle it. I think you have to treat the person who isn't drinking with as much care as you do the person who does drink in terms of beverage choices. And there's certainly some very lovely and interesting drinks that you can offer and have them there for anybody, whether they drink or don't drink. So you can say, we have a red wine and a white wine. And we also have a blackberry apple ginger beer if you don't want to have any alcohol today. And I also have some sparkling water. What can I get you? The idea is to make everyone feel adult and comfortable, whether they drink or they don't drink. Don't call out the person who doesn't drink, because I think that can make someone uncomfortable. And these days, many people aren't choosing to have alcohol, particularly at a holiday gathering.
Well, also, you never know why somebody's not drinking. They may be taking an antibiotic. They may be an alcoholic. You know, it's really...
They may be pregnant and not telling someone.
Exactly. It's no one's business, first of all. Two things that come to mind are, you know, when I pretty much stopped drinking, I never expected every drink that I get now would have a straw in it. It's a children's drink, and that drives me crazy, and it's terrible for the environment. I have really...
Look at you, an environmentalist. Stop the straws. That could be our next campaign.
I mean, I have read, like, if we stop the plastic straws, we could practically, you know, reverse climate change. Okay, I'm exaggerating there.
I tell you, no idea how deep and wide your interests were, Stephen Petro.
Well, and now they go to shrubs, which are these dry vinegars
shrubs
that are the rage in the South where we are. And I think they're sort of moving out around the country. But, you know, hosts, I just want to remind you, fine to ask everybody if they would like something to drink. And if you're pouring wine and going around the table and somebody says no thank you, that means no thank you. Don't push them. Don't say, you know, well, we've made this, you know, organic margarita, blah, blah, blah. You have to try some. No means no. So we're going to move on to gifts. So when you have folks over, whether it's for Thanksgiving dinner or another holiday dinner in December, what do you like to get as a hostess gift, and what do you really hate?
Oh, I really love the idea of walking in and handing somebody something, but the whole trick is to not make the host work harder when you bring the gift. There's nothing worse, for example, than someone walking in with some flowers wrapped in paper and saying, oh, I brought you some flowers. So there, I've got to stop what I'm doing. I've got to find a vase. I've got to get those flowers in water. I've got to take the paper and throw it.
I've got all my vases lined up because my friends they don't know this rule, and they're bringing these, you know, gobs and gobs of flowers. I completely
and
agree.
I'm sure you have
a lovely selection of vases,
my friend. I don't doubt that. I like to bring something, and if you bring wine, it's nice to just say to the host, just tuck this away for you all for later, so they don't feel obligated to have to put it out on the table. They may have already made their wine selection for the meal. And if someone brings you a bottle, you're always in that place where you're like, well, I want them to open it, and show them I appreciate it. Maybe they want to drink that bottle of wine because they're a wine snob and they're not going to like what I'm bringing. And there's another million decisions you have to make when someone brings you a bottle of wine. Sometimes I like a little, maybe bring a few like nice pastries and say, this is just a little something for you all to have breakfast tomorrow because I'm sure you'll be tired from cleaning up. Or, you know, if you know the person well, I think maybe a gift certificate for a massage or a facial is really kind of, you know, if they're a good friend, that's a lovely thing. Say, I know you'll be exhausted from hosting us. Maybe this will help refresh you. Something that acknowledges that they're hosting you and you're treating them, you know. And, you know, worst comes to worst, a candle, some nice little hand towels.
You want to make it easy for the host. So things I like to bring, a potted plant, you can just give it to them and they'll put it aside. Set of jams, peanut butters, box of chocolates. You know, it doesn't need to be a big deal. It doesn't need to be expensive. It really just needs to be easy and to show some consideration. I guess the last part of consideration is also, if you know someone is, for instance, not drinking or an alcoholic, don't pull that bottle of wine out of your wine cellar and bring that. If someone's struggling with a weight-related condition, you know, keep that in mind too. Some of the most memorable Thanksgivings in my family came when I was a teenager. My dad was a professor at NYU, and every Thanksgiving, he would invite all these so-called orphans over to our house, and these were people that didn't have families in New York. Many of them were from overseas or other parts of the country, and so this was this wonderful opportunity to talk about our family tradition, our national tradition, and to learn about other peoples as well. So I'm always reminded of the Great Seal of the United States, or the motto, which is E Pluribus Unum, which means out of many, one. And so I think that is what Thanksgiving really should symbolize, and I hope that many of us will enjoy that aspect of it this year. How about you, Kim?
Stephen, well, I agree. I think the best gift that we can bring is one of inclusivity and love and good humor. It may sound cheesy, but I think it's now more important than ever. As we head into the holiday season, for me at least, I'm really thinking a lot about the St. Francis prayer, you know, that whole notion that it's better to understand than to be understood. And especially, at least when it comes to Thanksgiving dinner with people who have different viewpoints, It's that notion of sowing love where there's hate and bringing light where there's darkness. You know, the idea of what can I learn from this person as opposed to what can I lecture this person about? You know, so often we're not listening. We're sort of sitting there waiting for our turn to talk. It brings the focus back to gathering and to community and to mindfulness. You know, we're really messed up as a country right now, and the last thing we need is a fight. So I'm going to really try to go into every holiday gathering this year with that idea about what can I learn, not what can I tell somebody.
So let's move on to the highly controversial topic of holiday cards, paper or digital. I went out last week and I killed 1,000 trees and I bought 6 different kinds of holiday cards.
You know, Mr. Environmentalist, I see.
I know. And I got cards for people who have a sense of humor. I have cards for people who don't have a sense of humor. I guess what I like about them is it's a way to connect. And I love getting them in the mail, reading what people have to say, seeing their handwriting, even though this is becoming a lost art. So when I come to recommendations on this, though, I think that the first and the primary rule is whether you're sending a digital card or a print card is it needs to be personalized, period. I don't want to get a print card that just has a label on it and somebody signed their name, and I don't want an e-card that pretty much does the same. And you can do that. You can write a message in a print card, and even on paperless post or minted, you can write notes in these cards. So remember, folks, they are to connect, not to divide us, and it's not meant to just be like the lazy person's way out of something. You're top of my list, Kim. Do you want print or do you want digital?
I want a paper card, my friend. I think in this digital world, an analog card is a great thing. And I feel like when people send a bunch of digital cards out or just the card with the printed name on it, that they're, making themselves feel better. They're checking things off a list. Look at me. I've sent out my great Christmas card list. Although I do like the printed card with people's pictures from their kids for the year.
Really? You know,
It's me. Yeah, but I like to see what they're doing. Do you like the long, involved Christmas letter, the holiday letter that says,
admit, I miss my great Aunt Alice for many reasons, but most of all for her long 4-page Christmas letter that would really detail every tragedy that happened to her and her immediate family. I miss that.
It's fantastic. And how can you not have the great letters from your blowhard, relative that you can then mock for many weeks? It's comedy gold.
I know. I mean, I saved this letter from Alice, Aunt Alice. Her husband had died, so it was always signed, Love, Alice in Hollis, Queens, and from Al in Heaven. I mean, is there anything more perfect than that?
Fantastic.
And now Alice is with Al in Heaven. So.
And if you get a card, please let us know.
Yes. So before we check out and start to brine our birds, Kim, we're going to go to a lightning round. But do you brine, actually?
Oh, the dry brine.
What's the dry brine?
Where you, the day before, you rub the bird with a lot of salt and let it sit overnight. And then the day that you're going to cook it, you take the wrap off, you rinse the salt, and let it just sort of sit and get air dry a little bit and roast it. It has the same effect of brining without the big sloshy water. And, really, the gravy is going to cover a multitude of sins. And so the dry brine is a way to kind of help keep that meat moist without going through all the hassle. Works like a charm. I got it from the late Judy Rogers, who ran Zuni Cafe in California. Use it every year.
And can we find that on the New York Times cooking app
You could. NYT Cooking. Download the cooking app. We have an entire Thanksgiving guide for you. And the star of the show this year, I have to say, is my dry brine. So
please, of course,
get the app.
So what do you do if the food tastes horrible and you're a guest?
You shut the heck up.
Especially if you're at Kim's house, you do shut the heck up. I'm afraid
my
now.
My food will not be horrible at my house.
I'm afraid.
No. I think you take some small portions of everything because then it looks like you have abundance, but you don't have to slog through a giant helping of that horrible dressing. You know, just take a lot of small portions. Take a few bites, not going to kill you. I think the worst comes to worst. If somebody's pushing something on you that you can't eat, you can just say, my stomach is just a little bit upset, but I'm really enjoying this dinner roll or whatever. I mean, you just have to at all costs not let people know how terrible the food is. And if they offer you leftovers, you can take some and always do something else with them besides eat
it's
them.
It's called a doggy bag for another reason. And
for a reason.
And, you know, and my advice is, you know, you don't want to call attention to things that you don't want to eat. So I like to sort of move things around on my plate, kind of mush them up. You know, nobody will ever know what went in my mouth or not.
Would you ever put anything in a napkin?
Well, I have done that. You have to be very discreet about that, as though you're about to cough.
But then you have that cloth napkin, say, and there's that thing in there that you spit out. Then mm-hmm. what do you do? Do you take it into the bathroom? And I mean, what do you do?
I see that you have been at dinner with me. Yes, that is what you do. Now, what do we do about drunk guests?
Ah, the drunk guest. Well, you do not want to let the drunk hijack the dinner. I think sometimes you can go to the person who brought them and say, you're going to have to do something about Susan. But that, you know, gets into a deep codependency territory. Another option is to use your technique, take that person into the kitchen and say, you know, can you help me do something? And then send them out to take the garbage to the trash can. Perhaps they'll
and
pass
the
out in your lawn
and lock
the problem
the door.
Will be solved. You could do that. But if you give them a little harmless task to kind of keep them busy and make it kind of jovial and be like, I really need you. Can you do me a favor and reach this thing or do something? And if they're, you know, at least maybe break that moment that they're starting to go off and then find a way to perhaps get the person that came with and get them out the door or maybe offer them a cup of coffee, something else. Do something to break that momentum. And always, always, you cannot let them leave the house with their car keys in their hand.
No. It means calling an Uber, a taxi, holding on to those car keys. There's nothing more important
than
that.
You offer them an alternative way home. You say, you know what, I've got an Uber coming for you.
Right.
And they'll be like, I can drive. You'll be like, not from my house. You're not. Sorry.
Yes.
You have to just be firm, right?
As I said, we are the chief manners officers at our parties. So that means being firm. Kim, we've covered a lot of ground. And before we go, I want to talk about one last thing. And at my Thanksgiving table, we often go around and say what we've been grateful for in the past year. Let's do a one-off of that. You first, then me.
I love doing this too. And I'm grateful for friends like you. And I truly mean that, Stephen. We've known each other for a long time and I adore you. And I'm really grateful for my family and my child and my dogs and my partner. I think we can never underestimate the amount of bounty that we have here in America. So I'm really grateful for the food on my plate and really grateful that no matter what, this entire country comes together once a year over food.
And I'm grateful to you for not only joining me here today, but also for being such a wise and good friend, yes, for many years. I can't even count them now. And I'm appreciative of the really amazing folks at East End Hospice in Sag Harbor, New York, and these hospice workers have been taking such good care of my mom the last 6 months, and I'm grateful to them, and I'm grateful that I'll be able to spend Thanksgiving with my mom and the rest of my family. So, Mom, if you're listening, I love you. And, Kim, I love you, and thanks again for being with us today.
Oh, it's been my great pleasure. You're welcome, Stephen.
My guest host, Kim Severson, writes and cooks for The New York Times and the New York Times Cooking App. She joined me today from Georgia Public Broadcasting. And that's all for our holiday special. If you like what you heard, please subscribe on iTunes and consider leaving us a 5-star review. Next time, we address the holiday blues and hear more from psychologist and author Andrew Solomon. The Civilist is a production of WUNC, PRI, and me. My producer is Rebecca Martinez. Mark Blasco wrote our theme song. I'm Stephen Petro. Thanks for listening.